Hello, pokers and prodders, investigators and examiners, obsessors and double backers. I am Brooke Warner, and I am here as I am week in and week out with my very favorite co-host, Grant Faulkner, who is my favorite because I often hold his hand to the fire of hard topics and watch as he doesn't flinch. So, Grant, we're going to walk right into this tough territory today because we're taking on trauma and writing. And the reason is because I've immersed myself in Paula MacLean's new novel, When the Stars Go Dark, and I was surprised, actually, at how rooted it is in trauma, because I had only known Paula's previous work as being these epic historical novels that focused on famous women like Hemingway's first wife and Hemingway's third wife and the aviator Beryl Markham. And so, you know, I don't know if you've read any of those books, Grant. I actually think they'd be right up your alley because of the whole Paris and Hemingway connection.
Yeah, I haven't read the books, but I went through a significant Paris writers and artists in the 1920s phase when I was in college and in my 20s. So I know these women's stories and I'm really interested in them and their adventurous lives.
Yeah, well, something for your to-read list, but Paula's new novel doesn't follow the template of those previous books at all. It's not about shining light on an overlooked historical female character, but rather about a female detective in the 1990s who's grappling with trauma at every turn, you know, in her past and her present and her job, which is investigating tragedies like missing persons and kidnappings and murders. And so in preparation for this episode, I started reading Paula's nonfiction, her essays, her memoir. And lo and behold, you know, I discover that like so many other writers, she's deeply informed by her personal trauma, which she's super open about. So it's not like I'm disclosing any secrets here. And Grant, our listeners might not know this, but it's absolutely the case that we often discover our themes while we're figuring out what the episode is going to be. And so when I got to thinking about trauma as a topic, two things came up. You know, number one, we must have done it. And number two, it's such a downer, you know, and something that a lot of writers have judgment around, you know, particularly if they experience it themselves. But then the more I thought about it, the more I realized, you know, trauma is actually a real motivator when it comes to writing. Mm-hmm. It actually is an inspiration and it often keeps writers coming back to the page. And in this way, it's hard to quantify, you know, it's not good or bad. And obviously people don't want their trauma a lot of times, but it does drive story. So I wondered if you could give me your take on all this.
Yeah, I find trauma in writing about trauma, very interesting. And I have to note that I say that as one who hasn't experienced trauma in the deep and devastating sense that some have. I do know how creatively destructive trauma can be, though. Even the mild trauma I've experienced is very similar to depression in the way it can shut you down and how it can be painful to go there on the page in any way. I once heard a fantastic presentation on trauma and writing by the great writer Adam Johnson, who has won both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer. And he teaches a literature class at Stanford on what he called the trauma narrative. And it's a storytelling framework that he says is often punctuated by fragmentation and broken chronology and changing perspectives and holes in the story. And his premise is that conventional narratives, which are more cohesive and kind of put together in general, tend to flow from a character's choices and the conflicts that ensue relative to that desire. But the trauma narrative is the opposite. Instead of a hero moving toward achieving his or her desire, they evade what's difficult to confront. And so it's fascinating to me how trauma might shape a narrative in such an unconscious way.
Yeah, I see that in the writers that I work with. You know, I don't know if they're doing it so consciously in this way as like unpacking the trauma narrative, but they certainly are doing that kind of writing, you know, the broken chronology, the holes in the story. And I think, you know, there's this unconscious part that becomes more conscious as a person writes more, especially when they find themselves circling certain themes over and over again, because that can be an indicator that you are kind of trying to figure out what's underneath all of that, right? And trauma can be a real source of inspiration, as I said, but it can also be a source of obsession. And when I teach memoir, I talk to writers about this possibility that exists, of course, of getting into a loop, you know, which is the circling that I was talking about. It can stem from trauma. I think it's really important that writers not judge it, though. It's just something to look at and to understand, because some writers need to find a way, you know, another way in, right, to write other narratives. And other writers might find this sort of like bottomless wells of content and story from the very thing that they're circling. So I just think, you know, because we're talking about this topic today, and because it will likely resonate with a lot of our listeners, all of us are different, you know, and what might be a muse for one person can be a real problem for another. And still poking at your trauma, you can also risk re-traumatizing yourself. And so that's important to keep in mind. And there's also an opportunity to reclaim your story. And so I can't speak to what all the different factors are for different writers. I think it depends on a lot of things, you know, including the severity of the trauma, the amount of distance or healing a person has had from the trauma, and then also the degree to which a person is open about the trauma and maybe has started to consider the surviving of it as a means to helping others, you know, which can certainly be a driver of story. So, you know, and all of that is just to say it's both and trauma is very two-faced, and it's why today's show is called The Stigma and Inspiration of Trauma.
Yeah, it's two-faced or even many-faced, I think. It's a, you know, it's an obsession, it's an invasion, it's a type of predator. And I definitely hear you about how you can run the risk of re-traumatizing yourself by writing about it or, you know, just poking at it a little bit. You know, perhaps it's just a matter of time passing, or, you know, every trauma is its own beast to tame, because I also know that writing tends to be a great healer of trauma. So perhaps that's when it switches over to the inspirational side that you're talking about. You know, I think we're inspired by what we want to make sense of. So writing allows you to kind of cognitively process things. And when you write, you can put a name and a story to your trauma in a new way. We're also inspired by what we want to release. So writing allows whatever is pent up and festering to find a way out. And in fact, I think there's something, you know, about confronting trauma and excavating it that causes those memories to lose their emotional power. It's interesting to me because the word inspire means to breathe in. So you're taking in, you know, oxygen and nourishment from the world. But the inspiration behind trauma is more about breathing out.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that. I mean, I knew that. And yet it's interesting how when something is applied to a particular insight like this, it's like, yes, exactly that. I was actually thinking about when we interviewed Dani Shapiro, and she spoke about this idea of the unthought known, you know, which is a psychoanalytic term that basically speaks to this idea of knowing something that it's like it's in our bones, right? Mm-hmm. And for Paula, you know, the fact of her experiences growing up in foster care, those weren't unthought knowns, you know, those were her truths. And she has been working around those in her early work, in her poetry and her memoir. But now she's circling them again in her fiction. And, you know, it's sort of considered a shitty thing to do to suppose that novelists are bringing their personal experience to the page. You know, we've talked to novelists who bristle at the idea that their fiction is necessarily autobiographical. And yet, I get why the assumption is problematic. And when I found out that Paula had a lot of personal experience in the themes she was writing about in the new book, I actually found myself trusting the story more. Mm. And I guess, you know, her lived experience made me trust that she was an expert in her lived experience, that she knew about the things that women and girls suffer in this very intimate way. And it turned out that I appreciated the book more as a result of all of that. So I was just curious, Grant, if you've ever had that experience, and, you know, whether I'm just bringing my memoir bias to the experience of reading fiction.
Yeah, I don't know. I think a fiction writer, no matter, you know, who that fiction writer is, has to be able to convey a story with a powerful and convincing truth, you know, no matter their experience. And I guess you could argue, I'll just argue this for the sake of it, that not having had an experience can open a doorway to a truth that personal experience might not, because you're relying on your imagination and your objectivity more. And this made me think about Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage, which is often referred to as one of the best war novels ever written, but Crane didn't ever fight in a war. So maybe the ability to convey a story in a compelling, arresting, and true way has to do as much with the writing as it does with the experience. And every fiction writer has to channel an inner method actor, in other words, so they can act out many different roles on the page and, you know, be as convincing as Meryl Streep if they're any good.
Love that. Yeah. And good point. And let's see if Paula can shed more light on all of these ideas we've been talking about. What do you say?
Yeah, I have absolute faith that she will, and our listeners only have to wait a few beats before we're back with the great Paul McLean.
Welcome back, everybody. Today's amazing guest is Paula McLean, and she is the author of the New York Times bestselling novels, The Paris Wife, Circling the Sun, and Love in Ruin. She has also written two books of poetry and a memoir about growing up in the foster care system. She received her MFA in poetry from the University of Michigan, and she's the recipient of many prizes. Her writing is widely published, and there are lots of gems to be found on her website, paulamclean.com. Her newest novel, which is just out, is called When the Stars Go Dark. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you so much, Brooke. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
We're delighted to have you. So your earliest books were two books of poems, and your memoir, Like Family, was about growing up in the foster care system. Then your first novel was Coming of Age, which I imagine you pulled somewhat loosely from your personal story. Then you made this big jump to The Paris Wife and two subsequent books of historical fiction that featured female protagonists. And I'm curious because I finished this lovely most recent book that you've written, When the Stars Go Dark.
And I've jumped again.
Yes, that's the question. Exactly.
It's a big jump.
Yes.
It's a huge jump, but I've done a big jump before. Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, in one way, you could look at my writing career as schizophrenic. And in another way, I prefer the word intuitive. Yeah, I decide what to write not rationally at all. You know, I didn't decide to write historical fiction. When I had the idea for The Paris Wife, it had never occurred to me that I might ever write historical fiction. I didn't read it, and I just didn't ever imagine that would be part of my path. I got my start in poetry, right? Like a big story, let alone a sort of a bestseller, didn't seem to be on my horizon. But I picked up Ernest Hemingway's Immovable Feast, and this idea just came to me out of the sky. And so I went for it, kind of trying to make friends with my fraud anxiety, my insecurity, my mortal terror that I didn't have the chops to do it. And kind of the same thing happened this time. A couple of years ago, I was in the middle of writing the first draft of Love in Ruin, and I went for a dog walk. And in the middle of the dog walk, this character kind of fell at me out of the sky, this missing persons detective with all of her darkness, all of her flaws and darkness. I knew immediately where the book had to be set, in Mendocino, California, I grew up in California, which is really important to me emotionally. And I swear to God, Brooke, by the time I got home, I had the whole story. It was just sort of flaring there in my imagination. But again, same, mortal terror, insecurity, fraud anxiety. Do I have the chops to do this? And I just decided I had to try, you know, I had to try. I mean, that's what we do, right? If we're brave, right? When a door opens, we decide whether or not we're going to go through. And sometimes there's risks behind the door. And sometimes there's great transformation. And I feel like for me, every time I'm willing to throw myself over a cliff for an idea, I grow exponentially. I become a different writer. The writer who wrote The Paris Wife is not the writer who wrote A Ticket to Ride, you know? I grew, and I hope I grew in the writing of this book. I feel like I did.
That is so interesting on many levels, Paula. And the new novel is definitely dark. And I'm intrigued because you share in an author's note at the end that you had trouble sleeping while you were writing it, but also that the inspiration for this story truly struck you. And that's one thing that interested me in what you just said, is that you put together the whole novel essentially on this dog walk, which is just no fair, by the way.
Certainly still had to do the writing, if that balances out the accounting.
I'm curious though, how did it stay in that kind of form that you imagined it on that day, or did this, like, the depth and the darkness of it change you as you became, you know, if you took that risk?
Yeah. Great question, by the way. The main pegs or anchor points stayed the same. The missing persons detective with her dark past, the abducted teenage girl, that element, the town in crisis, the Mendocino piece, those were the three main pegs that didn't shift at all. I knew too that I wanted it to be not a mystery, but about mystery, you know, with a capital M, right? About how we live, how we go on when unspeakable things happen, when crisis and trauma come to us. So those things didn't change, but much, much, much did. For instance, there's a piece of the book that is, which draws on real historical missing people, missing girls, abducted children and teens in California at the time and in the same geographical area. And that was a surprise. I didn't know until the second draft that was going to be a piece of it. And it sort of came out of my research. I set the book in 1993 because I wanted to avoid a procedural. And I wanted to avoid, you know, everybody thinks they watch CSI, right? And they think they can solve a crime with their laptop, right? I wanted it to be pre-DNA, pre-cell phones, pre-internet. And so I'm like, okay, early 1990s. I set the book in 1993, kind of randomly. And then when I started doing this research, I learned that there were a string of mostly unsolved crimes against children and teens at the same moment. And that really struck me and kind of gave me chills. Like, here I am writing a story, and yet these families had that reality and the victims had that reality. And so I decided to kind of honor their lives and deaths and dignify their experience and their story by saying their names in the book. And in a way, once I had the idea to do it, it made total sense for me that there's the through line, right, in my work of drawing on facts, history, and weaving that in with fiction. Sort of, it's very different than historical fiction, right? So here it sort of has the feel of true crime, but there are parallels.
Interesting. And thank you, because I wanted to ask you about your own writing. Your own nonfiction writing is what I mean when I say that, because I read your most recent Modern Love column about taking a vow of celibacy and confessing the ways in which your relationships are informed by your traumatic past. And as you were talking, I was just thinking, like, it sounds to me this, you really have this process of following the thread. And I wondered if you could talk about writing this piece and whether you see the new book, When the Stars Go Dark, as a vehicle to share some of those more personal stories.
Completely. Absolutely. So what I'm doing here in the book, and I guess I decided to write the Modern Love essay as a little precursor to that, I'm connecting the dots pretty clearly between my own experience, my childhood trauma, sort of what I've lived through personally, and my work. Kind of for the first time, but also not, because I published a memoir in 2003, which was literally, it's a memoir. It's about my growing up in foster care. But honestly, Brooke, I don't know if you've read that memoir. Little Brown published it. It's still in print. But I had just graduated from, you know, getting an MFA in poetry, and that book is very poetic. It's very, what do I want to say? It's mostly written in scene, and it's written from the child's point of view. So there isn't a lot of the grown-up Paula doesn't sort of step forward to make sense of all this experience for us. It's written kind of very close to scene. And so this book sort of tackles the experience of trauma, how we heal from trauma, in a more philosophical way through the characters in the book. Sort of what we carry, how we help each other carry it, right? How we come to terms with the things we believe we can't be forgiven for. How we can recover pieces of ourselves that we've lost along the way. How, for instance, it was very important for me that my victim, Cameron Curtis, learn things about herself, that she doesn't remain a victim, right? That was a huge part of the story for me. It was important for me that my character, Anna Hart, the detective, though she has pieces of my childhood growing up in foster care, I've given her quite literally some of my family stories lightly veiled. It was important for me that she did have positive experiences in foster care when I had none. It was important for me that she had parents who loved her, foster parents who loved her, that she had pieces of herself that were unimpeachable, unsullied by her experience, and that she goes on to become a healer, right? Healed people heal, and hurt people hurt people. I mean, that's really a cornerstone of the book.
That's really interesting, Paul. And we've been, before you came on today, Brooke and I have been talking about the role of trauma in one's writing and how it can be both a stigma and an inspiration. And so I'm curious about the role that trauma played in your own, I mean, you touched on this, but how it plays or played into your own creative process, you know, how your understanding of the role, you know, changed perhaps as you were writing this.
No, I think that's a terrific question, Grant. Thank you so much. I mean, you know, I was a reader as a kid. I'm sure you guys were too. And we read to escape, right? With all of the implications of that word, right? As a child, I read to escape my environment, all the things that were so difficult and uncertain, all the displacement, all the loss, all the pain. I didn't know that I was creating a writer at the same time, right? That those worlds that I was flinging myself into, those characters I loved as if they were real people, felt like real people to me. And I was growing my empathy. I was learning everything I learned about being a human, I learned in books, right? It's given me a kind of, what I want to say, a greater interest in and appetite for the human story, sort of what it is that we're doing, why we're here, how we make meaning in our lives, how we find our purpose, even though life might give us a little too much pain. And it's, again, a big cornerstone of this book, a huge theme of it is how sometimes our deepest sources of pain can lead us very specifically to our life purpose. And how we can connect to others who have experienced similar losses. My victim, for instance, Cameron Curtis, and my detective, Anna Hart, share an emotional DNA. It's how they find each other in the dark.
Yeah, that is that shines through really beautifully too. I wanted to pivot here to ask about another deep kind of pain, although perhaps more shallow.
We seem to be having I guess it's a necessarily dark conversation. I mean, given the themes of the book.
Yes. And you're putting it out there, but actually this is about reviews. And it, you know, it's interesting. I mean, because I was just reading as much as I could about you. And I went back and I saw that The Paris Wife didn't get such a great New York Times review. And yet it went on to be a mega seller. And I was wondering, because I'm a person who takes issues with New York Times reviews from time to time. And you know, when it comes to women's books and women's stories, and I thought you'd be a great person to ask about that experience because, like, A, did it phase you? And B, you know, you went on to write all these other books. And so do good or bad reviews and major publications matter?
Oh my God, yes. And I was completely gutted by that. It was my first New York Times review, right? And I didn't get out of bed for 3 days because it felt so personal. Hmm. I mean, the reviewer called the Paris wife a bodice ripper, basically, you know? And, you know, and yes, and took my writing out, basically, right? And that's very, very difficult to recover from. I have made a pact with myself when I'm asked to review, and I have reviewed for the New York Times, to just not think of myself as the gatekeeper, right? That instead to praise what there is to praise about the book. They've given it to me because they think it has something that I'm the right person to review it, right? So instead of thinking that it's an opportunity to sort of decimate another writer, destroy them, which of course it can. It can. I mean, do reviews matter when it comes to sales? Maybe not. American Dirt, for instance, right, was eviscerated in most of the reviews. And yet it went on to sell millions. And readers themselves rate the book very highly on Goodreads. I read it and liked it a lot, you know, as a story, even though the politics and the problems with the politics make sense to me. So does it, a bad review in the New York Times necessarily mean the book won't do well? No. But it matters to the writer. Hell to the yes. It really mattered to me, and it was really difficult. And you know, I realized as soon as I began to talk that it was actually the review of Circling the Sun in the New York Times book review that called The Paris Wife a bodice ripper. So
two devastating
New York Times reviews. Yes, the one I think that you're referring to called Hadley a bath mat. Or a dish rag or something like that. Like, why do we care about such a woman, a whining, useless first wife, essentially? It was horrible. But it didn't seem to matter, right, to readers.
Yeah, well, thank goodness.
Hopefully this New York Times review, oh my God, but of course I have total PTSD, right? I have the yips. Hopefully it won't be a similar experience.
I hope not. Well, Paula, we had your friend Christina Baker Klein on the show a few months ago, and we got into this great conversation about how female historical fiction writers are ghettoized, or often ghettoized, and she strongly rebuked the idea that she was a historical fiction writer. Mm. So I'm curious how you feel about this, given that reviews of this recent work do call it historical fiction. And I feel a little weird talking about the 90s as historical, given that I, you know, lived through them
hilarious.
And they were my favorite decades. But what is your take on this subgenre of fiction and your place in it?
So first of all, I love Christina and admire her work so much. And of her work, of course, as you know, is beautiful. It's literary. It's beautifully written as well as being big story. Right. So, and yet I see her point completely. Ghettoized, is that the word I'd use? I would say trivialized. Hmm. Trivialized as if we're doing something quite small, like writing quote unquote women's fiction, right? Chick lit, like history light, I've heard, right? Like Cool Whip light. It's derogatory, and it diminishes, I think, what it is I've tried to do in my work, which is to quite seriously take on a woman's life. It's a feminist act, but it's also an act of poetry, right? I poured everything I know about writing into The Paris Wife, right? And still stand by that book. I think there are writers who would never write historical fiction because they're afraid that they're going to be put in a box, that it's considered a limitation. And there are readers who won't read it because they think that it must not be for them because it's slight or because, right, just telling a woman's story. But I, you know, I really take umbrage with that. I think that there are higher forms of art within every genre. Don't you agree? Right?
Absolutely.
Within detective fiction too, or even cozy mysteries. Like, there are beautifully written books in every genre, and we should sort of take each one as they come and judge it by its own merits instead of what little category it fits into.
Preach. I love it.
Preach.
So in closing, Paula, I wanted to ask you about two parts of this book that you actually already spoke to a little bit, but this kind of diving in a little bit deeper. So Mendocino on the one hand and Polly Klaus on the other hand.
Yes.
You talked about growing up in California. I'd love to hear why Mendocino. Maybe it was a personal, more personal connection to Mendocino, or just how perfect it is for mysteries. And then secondly, about Polly's story, you mentioned that you uncovered it in the research. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about those two through lines and why Polly's story is part of the story, but not the story.
Absolutely. And if I miss a stitch, bring me back to it. So the Mendocino piece, I grew up in Fresno, California, which is in the San Joaquin Valley. And this was, born in 1965. So, and then I left when I was 21, for various reasons, which I won't go into now. But after I was newly married the first time, my then husband and I returned to California to visit my sister, who had taken a job as a broadcast journalist, and she had taken a job near Mendocino and was living in Mendocino. So basically, this visit to her in Mendocino was kind of not long after we had aged out of the foster care system, within 5 or 6 years of that time. And it seemed in that moment that we had made it, that we had come through the gauntlet kind of unscathed. Here she was, like, reporting on the evening news. And here I was, married, about to have a baby. Like, we had legitimatized our lives. We had grown up. We had come through, right? And what an extraordinary moment that was. Like, we'd grown up. We had somehow made it. And that occurred to me then on a hike in Mendocino through the fern forest, a location that I bring to life in the novel, right? The dripping prehistoric ferns and the crashing Pacific and the towering redwoods and the eerie kind of almost supernatural fog and all of that very specific to that place kind of embedded into my imagination. And I didn't know they would take another almost 30 years to come out again. Right. I never had a moment to write about Mendocino until the idea for this book came. And I'm like, a suspense novel? Well, I know where a suspense novel could be set. Mendocino. And it is perfect. I mean, it is a perfect place if you've ever been there. It's time out of time. It's a place out of time. It's a Victorian village kind of that looks, you know, that it could be trapped in amber, that it hasn't aged, and just the physical place itself, the weather and the quiet, the eerie quiet, and all of that was absolutely magical to me. So Polly Klaus, very known to history, probably the most publicized child victim kidnapping, you know, in history, disappeared from her bedroom in Petaluma, California, in the middle of a slumber party when she was 12 with two of her 12-year-old friends looking on. And of course, I knew about Polly Klaus, but what I didn't know, Brooke, was that she disappeared in early October 1993, I had already written my disappearance as late September 1993. The surprise was when I went back and started looking at Polly's disappearance was that she disappeared 10 days after my imaginary victim went missing. And that was the aha, the eerie aha moment. And that's when I decided to make Polly Klaus's disappearance a plot point in my book, that the detectives in my book sort of course, become aware that another girl goes missing 60 miles away. Are they related? Are they not related? And it gives me another opportunity to explore why some cases become national and international news and some are a blip. Why some children make the milk carton and others simply vanish. Like, why is that true? And of course, I make that a point for my detectives to kind of think about what that actually means, emotionally speaking, too, as well as literally speaking.
Indeed, you do. And there's so much wonderful stuff to unpack. So thank you for writing it. And thank you for coming on today to talk to us about all of this stuff. Thank you.
Absolutely. I hope that even though we did discuss some pretty dark themes, I hope that you saw and read hopeful messages.
Oh, 100%. Yes. And I want to encourage.
There's a great deal of hope I meant to write into the book, and a lot about healing and redemption and recovery and self-rescue and all the other good things as
well. All of the above. Yes.
You guys asked some fantastic questions. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast as a guest. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. We will be right back, everybody, with this week's book talk right after this short break.
Today's book pick is Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn. And Sharp Objects is one of those books that I actually read after I watched the series. And I don't even remember which of the networks carried this, but it was a short series on TV. And the protagonist is Camille Preaker, who's a reporter, and she's assigned to her hometown of Wind Gap, Missouri, to cover the story of two murdered girls. And when Camille gets down there, back to her hometown, she starts to experience the effects of trauma from her childhood experiences. And it's really an amazing series and book. And so, of course, when I was reading Paula McLean's book, I was thinking about Sharp Objects and the points of intersection. In this case, Camille is a reporter. In Paula's book, her protagonist is a detective, but they're both being triggered by old memories as they come back to their old stomping grounds and revisit what happened there as they're trying to simultaneously deal with what's happening in the present. And so in that way, there was a lot of overlap. And this is just one of those books and shows that is disturbingly good, you know, has a lot of darkness in it, but also, you know, points of interest and redemption and healing, just like Paula was just saying. So I highly recommend you check it out, one or the other. But of course, the book is always better.
Yeah. I haven't read the book, Brooke, but I saw the show. And I got to say, that show was just amazing. And I think you said it was disturbingly good. I think that's the perfect way to put it. So we try to be undisturbingly good every week with Right Minded. We're here every week, so you can download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you go to get your podcasts. We're basically everywhere. So if you can also, while you're there, you know, we love ratings. So if you can get us a rating, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much, and we will see you next week.